and let me add my welcome to you as well. It's lovely to be here with you and to look at Psalm 3 together. I wonder how you'd respond if I asked you what your worst nightmare is, what your deepest fear is. Of all the nightmares you've had and thankfully woken up from, which one were you most glad to have that moment of relief when you realised, oh, thank goodness, that wasn't real, it was just a dream? What's your worst nightmare? Your deepest fear? Perhaps it's being forced away from the comforts of your own home at short notice and forced to live somewhere else, strange and uncertain. Maybe it's having people turn against you, betray you, curse you and reject you. Perhaps it's relational strain, even breakdown in your family, those closest to you. Maybe it's being chased, pursued by others intent on your harm. Perhaps it's having your life put at risk, in danger, your death a very real possibility. David, the man who wrote the part of the Bible we're looking at this morning, Psalm 3, he's in the middle of living out his very own nightmare. He's in the midst of realizing his own fears. He's going through all of the scenarios I just mentioned and got you to think about at the same time. That's his experience as he writes this psalm. Can you see those words written at the beginning of Psalm 3 that Greg read out for us before verse 1 begins? A psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. What's happened that a father is being forced to flee from his child? What's led to David, Israel's king, being forced to vacate the throne and evacuate the capital? Well, Greg read for us a part of what happened at the beginning of our time together this morning. The book of 2 Samuel details David's experiences at this time. Backing up a little, his son Absalom had committed murder, fled and been away for 3 years, during which time 2 Samuel chapter 13 verse 37 says, King David mourned for his son every day. Absalom finally returns to Jerusalem and lives there for 2 years, but without seeing the king's face, his father's face, chapter 14 verse 28. As time went on, Absalom, he starts acting in place of the king, his father, fielding complaints from the people before they get to the king, flattering the people, pandering to the people. And so 2 Samuel 15 verse 6, he, Absalom, stole the hearts of the people of Israel. 4 years on, and Absalom goes to Hebron, sends secret messengers throughout the land to say, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, Absalom is king in Hebron. And so chapter 15 verse 12, the conspiracy gained strength and Absalom's following kept on increasing. David, father and true king, has no alternative but to rapidly flee Jerusalem with whatever other loyal leaders he can muster. Escapes down the steep descent from the capital, crosses the Kidron Valley and makes his way up and over the Mount of Olives to the temporary safety of the desert. Along the way he gets loudly and openly cursed and physically abused. The enduring image of David at this time is what we're given in 2 Samuel 15 verse 30, which we read and which describes him as weeping as he went, his head covered, and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too, and were weeping as they went up. Forced and indeed rapid relocation. No place to lay his head. betrayed, cursed, and rejected by men, family tension and breakdown, pursued, his life at risk. This is the stuff of nightmares. David, his fears have come real. And so reflecting on his situation, his experience, fleeing from the face of the presence of his son Absalom, David, he turns to the presence of, he deliberately seeks the face of his Lord, his God, and writes Psalm 3 verse 1, O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. It's interesting, given his situation, his experience, what David writes here, because clearly the state of play, humanly speaking, it's dire. This is personal. He has foes, adversaries, enemies, and they are many. And this group of many, they have risen up, they have stood up against him. There is an activeness now coupled with both the volume and the personal nature of this opposition. But the climax of the situation, the experience, at least as David expresses it here to his Lord, it's not the forced and rapid relocation, having no set home. It's not being betrayed, cursed, and rejected. Not the family tension and breakdown with his son Absalom. Not being pursued and having his life at risk. The climax, as David calls out to his God, is what is being said of David and David's God. Isn't that the sense of what we have written here? That yes, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? But even more so, verse 2, that many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. You see, isn't the real threat here, isn't the worst nightmare, the deepest fear of all, that there is no salvation for David in his God? That God will not deliver him. Charles Spurgeon, the 18th century Baptist preacher, commenting on these verses, says, "It is the most bitter of all afflictions to be led to fear that there is no help for us in God." That is the most bitter of all afflictions, isn't it? And isn't that actually the source of your worst nightmare too? The location of your deepest fear, out of all the nightmares and fears that you might have, both imagined and real. That whatever it is that you have put your hope in, for this life and the next, whoever it may be that you are relying on, depending on, will not pull through for you. Will not be there for you in the end. Will not deliver the goods, but will rather let you down and leave you hanging and empty-handed. That God, and I'm not even necessarily thinking about the God of the Bible at this point, but whatever, whoever your God is, what you're hoping in and relying on, that God will not save. Isn't that your worst nightmare? Your deepest fear? Well, how does David respond? At such a time as this, what is David's response? From verse 3, the focus in the psalm shifts from the multitude of enemies to the character of the one God. A shift from those who are against David to the one who is on David's side. A shift from what some would claim to be true of God to the reality of who God actually is. A shift from the mocking testimony of others, God will not deliver him, to an alternate testimony. An alternate testimony of who and what God is like towards David, for David and to David. And so verse 3, but you, signalling the shift to David's alternate testimony, but you are a shield around me, O Lord. What do you need when there are many foes against you? Many enemies who have risen up against you. You need cover. You need protection. And David knows there's none better than the Lord himself, because he is a shield all around him, in front and on the side and behind him, as we saw with the kids. You bestow glory on me, verse 3 also, as the honour and the glory, the popular acclaim that David had received from people had been shown to what it so often is like, fickle, temporary, self-interested. David testifies that the Lord, God, is his glory. He is where David's honour and glory is located, in God, not in men. You are a shield around me, O Lord. You bestow glory on me. And end of verse 3, you lift up my head. That is a beautiful picture, isn't it? Remember the situation, the setting, David's experience, that image from 2 Samuel 15:30, David weeping as he went, his head covered and he was barefoot. He's been brought low, downcast, but this God, his God, is the one who makes a habit of lifting up drooping heads. Given that God is his shield, his glory, the one who lifts up his head, David's experience is that his testimony is that verse 4, to the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. David lifts his voice to the Lord, and in contrast to those who are saying of him that there is no help in his God, God answers David. He hears and responds to David's cry. David seeks divine aid, and divine aid is given, received from his holy hill, that is, from Jerusalem, where God has chosen to dwell for his people Israel at that time in a special way. Even though, remember, David is no longer there himself, his testimony is that he answers me. Verse 5, I lie down and sleep. Remarkable, supernatural, we might even say, given the circumstances. I lie down and sleep. I wake again. Why? How? Because the Lord sustains me. And how true that is for all of us, whatever our situation, and whether we realize and acknowledge it or not. We only slept last night and woke again this morning because he himself gives life and breath and everything else. Only because in him we live and move and have our being. There is someone else who sustains us, the Lord. And so verse 6, David declares, I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Here are the many of verses 1 and 2 again, but they are not cause for fear, though they have set themselves against David, though they are all around David. No, they are no cause for fear, not when his God is a shield all around him, not when God is his glory and the lifter of his head, not when the Lord answers when he cries out to him, when the Lord sustains him. It is a wonderful alternate testimony to the Lord, this one that David gives here. And having been brought through David's alternate testimony, his experience of who God is for him, even in the midst of these circumstances, these experiences, we return in the final two verses, verses 7 and 8, to the place where we began. To that worst of all nightmares, that deepest of fears, the doubts and the questions expressed at the beginning in the mocking by the many, God will not deliver him, God will not save. It's brought through to the end here, where David responds by calling out to the God who does save, and declaring that his God is the God who saves, that from the Lord comes deliverance. See from verse 7 there, arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God, strike all my enemies on the jaw, break the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. David's words here in verse 7 they echo Moses' cry back in Numbers 10 as God's people left from Mount Sinai after having received God's instruction. As the Ark of the Covenant set out amidst opposition, this was Moses' cry. Here, David is setting out from Mount Zion, from Jerusalem, actually with the Ark as well for a time. And so he echoes Moses' cry. And of course, you only call out to your God to arise. You only cry out to God, deliver me, if you believe that your God is a God who saves. If your God is a God who can do something about your situation. That's why David calls on God to strike the jaw, an act of rebuke, correction. For God to break the teeth, which is to make something or someone harmless. You only call out to your God, you only call on your God to do that if he can actually pull it off. And David's God can. Because verse 8, from the Lord comes deliverance. Salvation belongs to this God. Given his situation, verses 1 and 2, given his testimony, verses 3 to 6, David, applying his testimony, what he knows of God, to his situation, David desperately but confidently pleads with his God to save, verse 7, because he knows, verse 8, that his God is the God who saves. God will not deliver him, verse 2. From the Lord comes deliverance, verse 8. David was, of course, delivered. David's God did pull it off and pull through for him. His son Absalom foolishly heeded some bad advice and failed to deliver the knockout blow while his father was most vulnerable. By the time the battle did get underway, David had had sufficient time to gather resources and strength to prepare for it. And 20,000 men, David's foes, his enemies, were killed, including Absalom, though David wept and wept over his son's death. The Lord's deliverance, the fact that God saves, was of course to the great good and benefit of David, but interestingly, that's not the note that the psalm ends on. You see, doesn't the ending of the psalm strike you as strange at first? Verse 8 again, from the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on me, David. No, that's not what it says. Though that's what we'd expect, given the way that the whole psalm has gone. It's been all about David all along. Have a look again at verse 8. It says, from the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. You see, there is blessing in God's deliverance, in the Lord's salvation, not just for David, but for all of God's people. Because when God's king, the rightful ruler, is delivered and restored to reign as he ought, it is for the great good and benefit of others as well, for all of God's people. And this, I think, is where we come in. Because this psalm, it's not immediately obvious how it relates to us. It's actually not directly applicable to any of us. I'm not David. I'm not the Lord's anointed king. You haven't been pushed off the throne. None of us have been through these particular experiences that David has been through with his son Absalom. But Psalm 3, it does relate to us. It does apply to us. It is a word for us. In the sense that David's experience here points us forward to an even greater king. And what is said here about the Lord and his deliverance points us forward to an even greater deliverance, salvation, one in which lasting, eternal blessing flows as a result. You see, like David, we read that in the Gospels, Jesus too, from Jerusalem, crossed the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives. And it was there that he too prayed, "Take this cup from me. Deliver me, O my God." And yet the response of the God who saves on that occasion was strangely in the negative. It was there at the Mount of Olives that Jesus was betrayed. He would go on to suffer the verbal and physical taunts and attacks of others. He saved himself. He saved others, but he can't save himself. He was a man of sorrows, with not just his head, but his whole body bowed under the weight of a cross. He suffered the anguish not of a son's rejection of a father, but a father's rejection of his one and only son. And yet it was from that Lord, the Lord Jesus, the God David had prayed to, now come in the flesh, and from that event, from his death followed by his resurrection, that deliverance, salvation did indeed come. He saved others by deliberately, willingly not saving himself. And that instead of deserved curse, God's blessing might indeed come and be on his people forevermore. You see, salvation does indeed belong to the Lord. There truly is a God who saves. His name is Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Why then tremble before the lesser nightmares of life, when the worst possible nightmare has been overcome for us? Why cave in to the lesser fears of life, when the deepest of fears has been dealt with on our behalf through Jesus? Will God deliver, rescue, save me, save you? The response from God's word is a resounding yes, because it was firstly no to Jesus. Declared and foretold in Psalm 3, foreshadowed in David's experience, fulfilled and accomplished in Jesus, the one who died and rose again to bring us that salvation. Let me close with some words from Romans 5, and then you can have a few moments to think and reflect on some questions and pray on your own. Romans 5, since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if, when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? I'll give you a few moments to reflect on the questions on the screen.